And who's this right here?
Jacob.
Who's Jacob?
Jacob is our friend in Africa.
It took a week and a half for Kony 2012, a viral half-hour documentary made by a charismatic American youth group to raise awareness about Ugandan warlord Joseph Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army, to become the fastest-spreading video of all time, garnering 100 million views. But on paper, it's confusing to see why the video has gotten so much attention, heavily in the United States. It's half an hour, it's a documentary, and it's about Africa. Three ingredients that would seem the least likely to attract millions of 13 to 17-year-olds, let alone get them to retweet it, post it on their Facebooks, and petition their favorite celebrities to watch it too. But it only takes one viewing to understand why Kony 2012 hit big. It's simple. It features cute children, it tugs on the heartstrings, it has a great soundtrack, and it views the issue almost entirely through Western eyes. It also ends with a message that anyone can identify with, that you can make a difference simply by sharing the video. Some of the reasons the video hit big are the same reasons it has been the subject of intense criticism. And in a weird self-perpetuating cycle, the intense criticism has helped the video hit even bigger. Like any simplification of an intense and complicated issue designed to influence attitudes, the film is low on context, fudges several facts, and suggests a solution that many disagree with. In fact, it is propaganda. Rosabel Kagumera is a journalist and blogger based in Uganda and the editor at Channel 16, a blogging platform for responding to emergencies and conflicts, mostly in Africa. In a conversation we had over Skype, she raised some of the concerns Ugandans have brought up about the film.
I thought it was too simplistic, and it was basically ignoring Ugandan efforts into this whole conflict. It was basically telling the viewer that there are 30,000 African children in a jungle, and nobody in Africa has done nothing until I reached, and I promised this boy that I would save him and I would put an end to this conflict. That is too simplistic. I felt like it was feeding in the already existing prejudices about Africa, like we sit here and wait for people to help us, and that for me was very infuriating.
What is the reality of the situation? The LRA have been around northern Uganda and in Congo and the Central African Republic for the last quarter century. What has been the situation more recently? What would be a more correct way of stating what the condition is right now?
Well, LRA fought most of its war in the last 26 years in Uganda and South Sudan. But that changed in 2006 when Uganda government had peace talks with the LRA. These peace talks were brokered by the government of South Sudan. In fact, the current vice president of South Sudan, Dr. Riek Machar, was the mediator of the peace talks. And it achieved a lot for northern Uganda because we managed to get Kony out. We convinced him to get out. And Uganda has not seen any attack from the LRA since 2006. So what we had from 2006, Kony moved to Garamba to set up a base in northeastern DRC, which is in the Oriental province. So after 2006, he stayed there for 2 years. And in those 2 years, the American government helped the Ugandan government in a military attack. They attacked Kony's base, but didn't achieve anything. It was the most failed attack that we had seen.
Before 2006, most people were living in an internally displaced people's camp. Up to 1.5 million people are living in camps. Most of them have gone back home. So they have new challenges and no social services working. So everything is starting from scratch.
Has there been support for people who are returning home to recover and deal with those traumas?
The Uganda government drew up a plan, but the progress has been really slow. So there's a gap between when people are in camps and when people will finally settle. And that gap has been largely ignored.
A lot of the focus of the campaign, the Invisible Children campaign, has been in chasing down Kony and the LRA. Would you say that that approach, is it still something that people are interested in doing, or are more people kind of focused on the recovery effort?
It's still an issue. But the thing is that there was nothing new the video was bringing up. There have been efforts for the last 3-4 years to track down Kony. And this last year, the government of U.S. sent troops. Of course, we all know that there have always been some American involvement in the war.
What was the reaction to the video when, as people learned about it and as people were finally seeing it in Uganda and especially in northern Uganda?
Some people have heard about the video, and I asked them, have you watched the video? They said, no, we know that it's full of nothing. But in northern Uganda, where people don't have access to internet mostly, they were particularly incensed about the idea that somebody is going to walk around in a T-shirt that has called his name on. He shouldn't be wearing a name of a war criminal. It has never happened anywhere. Why suddenly does this happen for African victims?
There's a lot of attention on this issue that's seemed to come out of nowhere. What do we do with all this attention now? We have over 100 million people watching the video. What would you say to folks who have seen the video, have been inspired to do something, but don't know what to do?
100 million people knowing something does not necessarily change anything, you know? So at the end of the day, it's the right people having the right information. It's not about 100 million people in the world. I do not think that a misinformed youth in America would give us an informed policy that would end conflicts on the continent. We know that these people, invisible children, could afford to go to Congo to show us the plight of children in the Congo. But they decided to use images of 2003 to try to put up propaganda. I think the video points them to the wrong direction. We have tried the military action over years. It does not tell them that the military action we are talking about is extremely difficult, that you would come with fatalities if you're to attack Kony, you would kill children that you're planning, that you're talking about saving.
Have there been any responses in Uganda that have surprised you, opinions or reactions to this sudden attention?
No, most people, those who are not necessarily critical of the film, are skeptical. They're asking, why is America being encouraged to come here militarily at this time? People are very cautious because we have oil right now. People are knowing that our future, our stability can depend on one thing called oil. And they are trying to evaluate all these measures by any country coming to Uganda. But when it comes 10 years too late, people are suspicious. That is the thing. Those who are not against it are questioning why. What do they want? They cannot get the answer. They are ignoring Congo the same way the world ignored Uganda 10, 15 years ago when people were dying at the highest. And right now, Uganda is peaceful. And I think the story of Congolese people and Central African Republic is the most urgent story that should be told to the world, especially those people who want to make a change. Because at the end of the day, this campaign has Uganda and Kony. It tells somebody, well, you must do something about Uganda. It does not talk about Congo. It does not talk about Central African Republic or South Sudan, where all these newest victims are. So you have Uganda in the limelight, but you have people suffering much more currently in Congo and other countries.
Roosevelt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ramon.
Roosevelt Kagamera is a journalist and blogger based in Uganda and the editor at Channel 16. But how did the film spread so far and wide? Gilad Loten, a vice president of research and development at Social Flow, did some network forensics on the spread of the Kony 2012 video and found some interesting results.
Yeah, so it was really fascinating to dive into the data. And what I did a few days ago was just grab all of the sort of the earliest references to their campaign, to Kony 2012 and to Stop Kony. It was very clear that there were pre-existing networks on the ground. So on our blog, we just put up this network graph of the first, you know, 5,000 people who talked about the campaign. And you really see these dense clusters emerge, right? All these people who are already connected and are most likely from sort of the same geographic regions. And what's interesting about it is they're not the regions that we typically see big cultural memes coming from. So you see Birmingham, Alabama was one of the very sort of the first core places where lots of users who are connected to each other started talking about Kony 2012. Englewood or Dayton, Ohio, I mean Pittsburgh, Oklahoma City, Noblesville, Indiana. Right, so these are cities which are not typical for larger memes on Twitter, and I think it gives us some idea of where sort of the pre-existing networks of invisible children were at before the video was placed online. Right.
Yeah, I wonder if you could contrast that with other memes that you've done research on. Like, what kind of other memes are you thinking of?
News events, for example, breaking news about Osama bin Laden, right? So before the media knew and before the White House announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed, people on Twitter figured it out. And when you see that cascade, it was sort of seeded from one account, but there were journalists and there were people associated with the media, but it was mostly sort of big cities, so New York City, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco. I don't think I've seen yet a meme that's come from cities such as, you know, Oklahoma, Noblesville, etc.
What can we glean from what we know about the folks in these cities and what we know about their profiles?
We haven't had time to really dive into the full data set yet, but it's clear that these profiles, like a lot of them are young, so a lot of them are teenagers, they're in school, and many of them are Christian, so quite religious. I've seen, like, many of the profiles have psalms, they link to different psalms on their bios. They talk about Jesus, God, Christ.
And you've actually got a word cloud from the most common words that appear in the user bios, and those things that you mentioned are in those.
Yeah, and that's in this cloud. So I do this for different memes and different stories that we track, and here it's clearly very, very different. So these are students,
and most of them are. We can assume that they're real people as well, as opposed to some other attempts at social media campaigns using Twitter that rely on bots and things like that.
Like at the very beginning, when I looked at the data, I was a little suspicious because it's just the types of profiles. I was not used to seeing these kinds of profiles, but I mean, they use Twitter very, very differently. So it's very conversational, sort of short tweets. I'm used to seeing like profiles who use it for, you know, professional service and you know, post links and talk about news. But this is a very different crowd, and they use it very differently.
That's one aspect of the campaign, having the pre-existing network in place. Some people have called it a Twitter army. But there's another aspect to it that you highlight that involves the actual tactics and strategy of the Invisible Children campaign of using Twitter, and that's been to contact celebrities.
Effectively, what they did is help the user base put a ton of pressure on celebrities. When you go to the website, you see the video. If you scroll down, you see a grid that shows all these celebrity profiles. All you need to do is hover over a picture, click on it, and there's text right there. So it's already complete for you. All you need to do is say, tweet it out now, and it pings the celebrity. It says something like, you know, Oprah, have you seen this? You have to come out and support it. And what we noticed is that the celebrities were being pinged like tens of thousands of times within a day or two of the campaign starting. So think of the pressure that they get. I mean, just the sheer amount of pings that they get on Twitter. And a lot of them do use Twitter. Some actually don't. Like Angelina Jolie is not on Twitter. Instead of at mentioning Angelina Jolie, they had a hash, like hash Angelina Jolie. The interesting thing was that they got a whole bunch of celebrities to talk about it at the same time, which sort of heightened the whole buzz. So you got a really good, like, high quality piece of content, and you have these networks that are already seeded and that are sort of starting the conversation in different parts of the country and really spreading it. So doing a good job at, like, multiple times during the day posting to the hashtag. And then on top of that, you have these celebrities that are getting just a ton of requests to talk about it. And it's interesting because, like, if you go scroll down Oprah's account, she'll be like, she responds and she says, well, I've supported this cause before and I totally support them. And then she gets more and more pressure and she says again, yes, I support them. And okay, I'll bring them on the show.
We can assume maybe the celebrities responded in some ways because of the pressure. In some cases it was because they've never gotten this much this many messages from fans on Twitter before, and in part it has to do with the quality and impact of the video itself, which certainly inspired people to tweet in the first place.
Yeah, correct. So celebrities, they're used to getting whatever they say gets reposted like often. So Oprah may say something and then she'll have like 10,000 people retweet it. But I suspect they're not used to getting such a strong sort of incoming voice.
So I noticed from the network graph that I Am Kristen Bell is a particularly large node, and she's known for reacting very emotionally to things that she sees. In the first case, it was sloths. In this case, it was this video that must have grabbed her.
Oh, I didn't know about that. Yeah. So she actually, so in the graphs, the more red a profile, the earlier they joined in on the cause. So she's one of the earliest participants in this event, and I think there's some pre-existing relationship between her and the Invisible Children. Maybe just Jason Russell. She's clearly in there early, and posting to the hashtag many, many, many times.
I think what's interesting in your research is that it attempts to reverse engineer some of the campaign tactics and bring draw a clear line between, you know, where Invisible Children might have started and where we've ended up.
The interesting thing is that data shows us, when we actually look at the data, it shows us some aspects of the campaign. It doesn't show us everything. I mean, Facebook played a key role in getting this campaign out too. Like when I talked to a lot of people, a lot of folks that have children especially, they were saying that their kids showed them the video, right? Their kids discovered it through Facebook and then sat them down and showed it to them because they were moved by it. But the fact that you had over 10 or even 15 highly, highly, highly visible celebrities on Twitter in the network talk about this sort of point to the same thing at the same time, so within a few hours of each other, that is, I don't think I've seen anything like that before, and that changes the game.
I think what's one of the other things that is interesting about this, and a lot of people have pointed this out, is this: the atrocities highlighted in the video have been going on for over two decades, and in the span of about 2 weeks, it's suddenly become front page news in a way that it hasn't been before.
Ethan mentions this term called attention philanthropy, right? And in a way, I mean, the feat that they managed to pull off, what they managed to pull off is really incredible. I mean, over 100 million people talking about Uganda, and most of them probably have never, like, put even a minute's thought about what's going on in Uganda. So that's pretty incredible, and I totally and wholly applaud the cause. I think the question is what they'll do now with the attention that they received. And I mean, with great power comes great responsibility. They have huge responsibility now to show that they'll actually be wise with the level of attention that they received.
What are your thoughts on the aspect of the campaign that some people would call slacktivism? You know, you are inspired by the initial push, which is the video, and then you can be activated by just the simplest opportunity to exercise power. Which in this case has been clicking a button and being able to send a tweet to a celebrity.
The campaign itself was well planned and it was extremely smart. I think they did a great job at capturing people's attention. But again, what does that mean? First of all, the tactics that they use, I'm not sure I completely agree with the mechanism. It's very smart. But getting, like, putting that much pressure on celebrities just means that next time their shells will be hardened. It might mean that they won't look at as much at what other folks write them on Twitter, for example, or on other social networks. It may mean that many other campaigns will try to do exactly the same thing, so get a ton of people to write these celebrities. So I kind of worry about what it basically what it teaches other campaigns and the relationship we will have with celebrities. But maybe it also teaches them to be a little more careful and wait a little longer and sort of study, do a more in-depth study of the causes that they support, which is effectively the way it's been done. Yeah, it's been done historically. And with regards to slacktivism, I think it goes back to the power that Invisible Children now has because of all this visibility. And yes, it's amazing that they got, they activated all these folks. It didn't happen overnight. It's something that they've been working on for years and years and years, going around all these schools around the country. So it's not totally slacktivism. It's actually like they have, you know, networks on the ground who managed to activate a whole number of people, right? And then the question is what they'll do with all this attention. And we're tracking that very closely.
I just want to say, I think that your point about the potential for celebrities to be a little bit more cautious in the future is an important one. What I think we notice when these social networks are tested and stretched in these ways is that initially there's a kind of like a naive, trusting optimism about them, and until, you know, a situation like this comes where you know, someone feels a little bit more used, and then they're a lot more cautious.
Exactly.
In the future.
Yeah, and when these networks get larger, they just get trickier to navigate, especially when audiences get so large. I definitely worry about that and the implications of that.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Yeah, thanks. It's been great.
Gilad Lotan is Vice President of Research and Development at Social Flow. You can find his work at socialflow.com. In the days after Kony 2012 broke, the founder of Global Voices and friend of the show, Ethan Zuckerman, spent some time correcting errors in the record as presented by Invisible Children and contextualizing the effect of widespread, simple, sometimes incorrect narratives on how issues gain traction.
This so far has been the most successful viral video in history. It's one of the most successful pieces of digital advocacy anyone has ever pulled off. I think in some ways that's different from the question of whether this has somehow changed the debate about Joseph Kony or about the Lord's Resistance Army or about Northern Uganda. And I would say that for me, that's quite a bit more questionable. I think what's so interesting about this is you've seen this organization pioneer a number of techniques that appear to be incredibly effective in getting people to pay attention to their video and join their cause in one fashion or another. But I think in some ways we actually have to separate that from whether this was the right way to portray this cause, whether this is the right cause to be pushing at this moment in time, and whether what they're suggesting as an intervention is actually helpful. So I think what's so hard about, you know, talking about the Kony campaign is that there's just so many facets associated with this. There was the campaign itself, and people are talking about how amazing it is that people have called attention to it. There are so many different flavors of criticism of the campaign. There's the flavor of criticism that it's oversimplifying and presenting a very naive view of the situation. There's criticism that Invisible Children may not be an effective on-the-ground organization, but is a more effective advocacy organization. There's criticism about the idea that this is a neocolonialist narrative of Africa and is not the narrative that many Africans want to show. So I think in many ways on this, you kind of have to pick which of the different facets you want to consider and then build from there.
Well, there's been a few different spheres of influence that we can begin to identify that have brought the video and the campaign to the forefront. Part of that has certainly been the effective on-the-ground network that Invisible Children had and the tactic of lobbying influence makers, celebrities and politicians to retweet this. I wonder if another couple of aspects that you highlighted, one being the simplicity of the video, another being the inaccuracy of that many are seeing in the video, have those been, you know, kind of reinforcing and building the momentum behind this campaign?
It's so interesting to think about these questions of how much can you simplify and you know, when does simplification become oversimplification? As it happens, I was just hosting a talk for Judy Richardson, who was one of the producers of Eyes on the Prize, the sort of legendary civil rights documentary. And she started talking about her frustration that more people know about the civil rights movement through Mississippi Burning than through her work on the documentary. Blockchain when she says that the problem with Mississippi Burning is that it turns the FBI into heroes, which she, you know, considers a narrative flaw that makes the whole thing unacceptable. And I think that there's a case to be made that a video focused on crises in northern Uganda that doesn't talk about the fact that many of the atrocities in the war were committed by the Ugandan army under the leadership of the Ugandan president, who still runs the country, and that a proposed intervention is essentially giving more resources to Yoweri Museveni, who's now in the 26th year of his rule, that you could make an argument that it's a similar oversimplification. But this is what I mean about sort of teasing the threads apart. When we try to figure out why this was so successful, there's several factors in play. Invisible Children did a great job of getting a network of people, many of whom they had met face-to-face in previous screenings, who they were able to rely on. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they gave viewers of the video something to do. Susan Sontag has noted that compassion is the most fragile of human emotions. You need to give people something that they can embrace and do once you've moved their hearts. And Invisible Children did a gorgeous job with this. They basically said, what you now need to do is buy our action kit, and you need to spread this video to all the other people you know. And in particular, you really need to spread it to people who have influence. And they made it very easy for people to do two mouse clicks and then send a message to people that they wanted to influence. Third, they managed to get some of those celebrities to jump on the bandwagon. And so you had Ellen DeGeneres getting tweeted 36,000 times in rapid fashion. And there are a lot of celebrities who responded to that by putting out a tweet and then mobilizing their own followers. So people who were not perhaps initially in Invisible Children's database suddenly were motivated when perhaps Justin Bieber brought the video to people's attention. And then, you know, there's another wave of traffic after that. We're still trying to find that in the data. One of the factors that may have had to do with why this was so successful was that the video is propaganda. It's carefully constructed to pull on heartstrings. It glosses over a whole lot of details in telling an extremely simple story. My sincere hope is that it's possible to use some of the techniques that Invisible Children use successfully with a more complicated video, that we don't have to get simplified down to the point where we just flat out get some things wrong or we flat out ignore some of the key concepts, but we can still get people mobilized behind it. But I'd really love to see someone test that and see whether that it is in fact possible or not. I think it may have to do with who next takes an international campaign, takes something like a push for a ceasefire in Syria, and builds a video that's compelling but not quite this simplistic, and see whether they're able to leverage some of these other aspects behind it.
Yeah, the critique of the video and the campaign has been in part one of the direction and the actions that Invisible Children is asking people to do, and in part the tactic itself, both of which are seen as simple. And if you're asking for an example, can you think of any examples of campaigns that have provided a more critically acceptable target and ask of their followers?
Well, it's hard. I mean, I think that, you know, first of all, in terms of social media, this is as big as anyone has ever seen, right? So we literally have not seen another campaign gain this much attention. And we would look at, you know, other YouTube videos and how many views it got. You know, the only things that are comparable are, you know, Susan Boyle singing I Dreamed a Dream. So there's nothing even sort of in the same range as far as the sheer volume associated with it. I think if the question is, you know, who has used social media to conduct a successful campaign, one possible way to do this would be to look at something like SOPAPIPA and say, do we think that the sort of distributed, somewhat decentralized movement to lobby against that legislation from ordinary net users, is that perhaps a counterpoint to that? I would argue that in some cases, you know, people were jumping onto SOPAPIPA, onto very simplified narratives and sort of following friends who they knew and trusted. And maybe that's the really complicated question. You know, is everything oversimplified to one degree or another? There's always an added level of complexity and subtlety that we'd like to bring in. For me, you know, I sort of feel like talking about the issues of northern Uganda in a way that appears to infuriate northern Ugandans and really has very few of them in the film, that's a sign that this goes too far on the other side. But your question, which is, you know, what's an example of an intelligent, thoughtful, subtle, and nuanced campaign that's gone viral? I don't have a good answer for you.
And that's what I'm wondering is if the simplicity and maybe, in fact, the inaccuracy is useful to the, if not necessarily the campaign, but the ultimate goal. On the one hand, the simplicity gets some people motivated. On the other hand, once people start discovering some inaccuracies, that more people are intrigued and interested and actually going to seek perhaps more accurate information about the issue.
I don't think that's the case here. I think that in some ways, Invisible Children is an interesting example of what Dana Boyd refers to as unseen audiences. This is a group that's used to talking to a particular audience. They're used to talking to high school students and, you know, turning them into movement activists. And they created a piece of media that obviously has been very, very effective at getting high school students and young college students to pay attention to, but reads very, very differently to some different audiences. It reads very differently to human rights activists. It reads very differently to people who work in Africa. And of course, one of the tricky things about the internet is that you never get to talk to just one audience anymore. You may think you're making this to sort of mobilize high school students to lobby Justin Bieber, to lobby President Obama, but it's going to get viewed and critiqued by a much wider audience as well. And so I think that, you know, this was not done to generate controversy. I think that the founders of Invisible Children are probably finding themselves both elated at how well this has done on social media, but also perhaps stung by the backlash and stung by the criticism. I actually come out fairly hopeful about this, where I end up saying, you know, there have been some very intelligent conversations that have come out of all of this. It's exciting that people are talking about what's a fair way to advocate versus what's exploitative. It's great that, you know, there are a number of Twitter tags out there about people talking about what they like about Africa and what they want people to celebrate about Africa. That's a wonderful reaction. And if there is some set of people who have gotten interested in the subject of the International Criminal Court and human rights abuses and who are doing the reading and the research around that, that's a wonderful thing as well. But I think this is what we have to recognize, is that someone's going to create advocacy media. It may well spark debate, dissension, pushback, and that whole large conversation is what we have to take seriously. Not just what someone says, but what the response is to it. It's possible that, you know, flawed media starts good conversations. I don't think that's a good argument to build flawed media. I still think it's an open question whether deeply flawed, oversimplified narratives are necessary in this case, or whether they're just what happened to go viral here.
Do you think ultimately this Invisible Children campaign will be good for the goals of people who are passionate and aware and concerned about the cause of these causes in Central Africa, about defeating the Lord's Resistance Army and Joseph Kony?
It's certainly drawn a lot of attention to Invisible Children. I think it's drawn a lot of attention to the LRA, and I think it's drawn a lot of attention to Kony. I'm not convinced that attention is actually the missing ingredient in arresting Joseph Kony. This guy is on the top of the ICC's wanted list. So it's possible that one outcome of this is that there's a lot of effort spent and it doesn't actually get any closer to his arrest. And I think that may be why people are looking for sort of secondary and tertiary benefits of all of this. Is it okay if this gets us no closer to arresting Kony, but it gets more people to be aware of human rights violations around the world? Well, perhaps. Is it okay if this doesn't get us towards arresting Kony, but it does mean that the U.S. spends more money supporting, a Ugandan leader who's really verging on dictatorship at this point? I don't think that's okay, and that's what I'm concerned about. But these are really hard questions. You know, is it worth that increase in attention if it leads to Kony's arrest, but if it leads to support for a government that participates in human rights abuses? That's the sort of calculus that's really, really hard to engage in. I think that's actually why it's terrific that this has turned into a public debate.
Ethan Zuckerman, thank you very much.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Amanda Tobe is one of the heaviest critics of the Invisible Children campaign. In a satirical post with her co-blogger, Kate Cronin-Furman, at wrongingrights.com, she created a drinking game for watching Coney 2012, poking fun at the both superficial and substantive problems with the Invisible Children's campaign. For example, every time you notice a statement that Africans are invisible if they aren't a cause celeb amongst middle-class white people, finish a bottle of wine, cry.
Our reaction, I think we were not surprised. This is pretty similar to the other types of advocacy that Invisible Children has done in the past, and we've actually been fairly critical of their past campaigns. The reason we found out about the video, actually, is we woke up the morning after it came out and found that our blog was down, because not only had we received more traffic in the 24 hours before that, then we had the entire year before. We were also currently being hit with a denial of service attack that we needed to deal with. And so we realized what was going on. We realized that the Coney video had drawn a lot of attention to a post that we wrote back in 2009.
So your first awareness of the video was a result of the traffic that your blog received?
Yes. Both of Kate and I teach undergraduates and happened to be dealing with midterms at the time that the video came out, so we didn't see it right away, but we figured out pretty quickly what was happening.
When you saw the video, were you surprised by the incredible power with which it swept the net? You said you've been aware of like their previous advocacy campaigns. So was this was it surprising that this one took off so much?
I was surprised just how quickly it took off and how broad a reach it has. That really speaks to Invisible Children's genuine skill when it comes to marketing and to making sort of emotionally compelling videos. There is some interesting stuff going on when it comes to online activism and how interconnected people are becoming online.
You've been critical of a few aspects of both the campaign and the video. I wonder if we could parse them out a little bit. One thing that you were critical of was the simplification that Invisible Children seem to create around this complex issue that's been going on for over a quarter of a century.
I think that my issues with the simplification kind of break down into a couple of categories. One is what that simplification involves in terms of its actual specifics, because what Invisible Children, their position is that they need to raise awareness, and to raise awareness, they need to have a narrative that is compelling to kind of average American college students, kids who use the internet, et cetera. And so what that involves is breaking down a complex regional conflict into a narrative that is not only very simple, but it also really removes the agency from the people who actually live in the countries that are affected by the LRA. So it means that instead of hearing from any African activists or policymakers in that video, we spend a lot of time with Jason Russell, the Invisible Children founder and filmmaker, and his young son. And, you know, they're clearly a very nice family, but I think that's a distinct... That choice has some distinct consequences in terms of removing the voice from people who actually are going to be affected by any policy decisions that are made based on this issue. A second problem is that simplification, by its definition, means information is left out. And here, some pretty important and relevant information was left out of this video. So for one thing, we heard absolutely nothing about the political situation in any of the countries that are affected by the LRA, certainly nothing about the Museveni government in Uganda or his military's past record of human rights abuses, use of child soldiers, et cetera. We didn't hear anything about other potential solutions to the conflict. So we only heard that what needs to be done here is military solution where the U.S. backs armies from the region. They hunt down Joseph Kony and then arrest him and send him to trial before the International Criminal Court. And that certainly is one of the options on the table, and I wouldn't really consider it my place to say whether it's right or wrong. But there's no mention in the video of other potential options. For instance, there's a great deal of support in northern Uganda within the communities who've been most affected by particularly the child abductions and a lot of the other atrocities that were committed by the LRA. There's a lot of support for a negotiated surrender, a peace agreement with the Lord's Resistance Army that would enable the soldiers who were originally pressed into service through abduction to return to their villages and go through local justice processes and kind of deal with the situation through the community in that way. There's no mention of the trade-offs of the military option that in the past when this has been tried, it's led to really terrible reprisals against civilians. In 2008, there was what they call it, the Christmas Day Massacre, in which a military operation against the LRA failed and resulted in them committing really horrible reprisals against civilians in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Hundreds of people were killed. More than 100 children were kidnapped and forced to become members of the LRA. When the narrative gets oversimplified and information like that is left out, it's not only misleading about the potential results of the policy goals they're advocating, but it means that the people who are being introduced to this issue through the video, who maybe have a genuine desire to get involved and find out more and support a solution to this terrible problem, don't have the information that they need to do that and are making decisions based on a skewed perspective.
Part of the power of the campaign is that it's, they present an issue that is so complex so simply and given people a clear action that they can easily do right away. Can you have your cake and eat it too? Can you have both a nuanced and not necessarily distinct one solution issue presented and also have this kind of deep engagement?
So I think that's kind of getting the question backwards. So awareness campaigns can be really effective in some contexts. I definitely am not dismissing them as a tool for political or social activism at all. But I think that we see them be most effective in two types of situations. The first one is where public opinion is the problem, and awareness raising can produce a positive change to popular sentiment. So, for instance, the use of awareness raising to reduce the stigma that was associated with being HIV positive, and to develop more humane treatment of people who are HIV positive or suffering from AIDS was a really great use of an awareness campaign. It was really effective, and I think it really improved a lot of people's lives because their awareness was itself the solution. Convincing people to care and to humanize the victims of HIV/AIDS was itself the battle that they were fighting for the most part. So that is one type of situation where awareness campaigns are really useful. And another is where the problem is abuses committed by an actor who will be directly affected by an awareness campaign. So, for instance, awareness of politicians, corruption, naming and shaming among the community that they are actually responsible to, so their electorate. Those types of naming and shaming campaigns are also very effective. But what Invisible Children is trying to do here is use an awareness campaign to apply to a third set of situations where to try to counteract persistent violations of human rights, but that are committed by actors who don't necessarily care who knows about their abuses. Naming and shaming doesn't necessarily help the situation. And in some cases, their goal is, in fact, to terrorize the population. And so publicizing it, I wouldn't say it does more harm than good, but it might not help. Joseph Kony is, unfortunately, more in the category of that type of actor. So the actors who are most capable of halting the LRA's atrocities in northern Uganda And the Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, Sudan, the other countries where they operate, are Joseph Kony and the other leadership of the Lord's Resistance Army. But there isn't really any amount of awareness that will induce them to change their behavior. So here, the goal shifts to affecting other actors, such as the U.S. Congress, who are more directly accountable to the people who are affected by the awareness campaign, but they don't have as much capability to actually fix the situation. You know, the LRA is not active in the United States. And so then you end up with a situation where you have this hammer and you have to make the Lord's Resistance Army look like a nail. So what does the U.S. government control? They control our military and our resources. And so these campaigns end up focusing on affecting our military and our government to get them to promise certain types of action against these the LRA and other groups who are committing atrocities. You know, now that this video has done a lot of work to get a lot of people very interested in this issue, and I think that there probably is a lot of hunger out there to find out more and learn more about what can be done, what the view from other perspectives is. And I know that I've heard from a lot of teachers in the last week or so who have said, my students are interested in this, I want to cover it in my classes, but I don't have the information to do that. So I'm putting together what I hope will be a useful resource for them, and it's going to be accompanied by an ebook, which will have chapters written by Ugandan journalists and activists, as well as academics and writers who have covered the LRA and studied it in depth.
If you were running the Invisible Children campaign, or it's almost a bad way of phrasing it, but if you had this kind of attention and you were able to say, okay, we have 100 million American eyes on this, what kind of action would you ask them to encourage?
So I think that for me, the most important thing would be to have a little bit of humility and consider whether it's reasonable to be dictating action or even urging action from our perspective as outsiders. There are so many experts from within the societies who are affected by this conflict who know more about it. They understand the trade-offs of different types of action. They understand what support there is within their community for different options. And most importantly, they're the ones who will bear the consequences of any type of action or activism that takes place. And we know from past experience that those consequences can be absolutely devastating. You know, it would be very easy for me from my home in America to advocate a particular policy, knowing that I won't have to bear the consequences in my own town, my own family, among my own friends. And so I think the thing that I would urge them to do would be to speak to Ugandans, speak to people from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, listen to them. They are, you know, you can find them on Global Voices, you can find them on Twitter, you can find them in news outlets throughout the world. Find out what they're saying, listen to them, and respect their, you know, their position of authority when it comes to making decisions over what should be done about their own lives and their own countries. And I think, you know, it's really important to remember that as people who are just finding out about this issue, no matter how well-intentioned we are, there's no reason to expect us to have the answers. There are people who have been living this conflict for decades. They have far more information than we as outsiders ever could, and I think the most important thing is to listen to them.
Thank you very much, Amanda.
Thank you.
Amanda Tobe teaches international law and human rights at Fordham University and blogs at wrongingrights.com. We end with two thoughts. The first from Berkman fellow Zeynep Tufekci, who wrote an intensely critical post on slacktivism and the Kony 2012 movement. Nonetheless, she ends on a hopeful note, quote, "Most lifelong dedicated activists have a gateway moment, often in their teens. It would not be surprising if the intensity of the attention to this video, as well as the intensity of the backlash, did not become just such a moment for many future leaders. The kids are listening, maybe to a simplistic message, maybe to a misguided cause, but some portion of them will keep looking, listening, and learning." And Norbert Mao, the Ugandan leader and politician who has actually met with Kony to negotiate peace talks in the past, counters one of the criticisms of the Kony 2012 video, namely that the video gives the impression that war is still going on in northern Uganda when in fact Kony has moved the LRA to the Congo. Mao says, "There are those who say the war is over in northern Uganda. I say the guns are silent, but the war is not over. The sky is overcast with an explosive mix of dubious oil deals, land grabs, arms proliferation, neglected ex-combatants, and a volatile neighborhood full of regimes determined to fish in troubled waters. What we have is a tentative peace. The military action in the jungles of the Congo may capture Kony, but we need to do more to plant the seeds of peace founded on democracy, equitable development, and justice. Like peace, war too has its mothers, fathers, midwives, babysitters, and patrons. Perhaps Kony 2012 will help sort out the actors. The video has certainly shaken the fence, making fence sitting very uncomfortable indeed." We put together an up-to-date set of links for understanding what is happening in Uganda and Central Africa right now and the Kony 2012 campaign at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Radio Berkman is shared under a Creative Commons license, so feel free to share it with Justin Bieber on Twitter. This episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with help this week from Francis Harlow and Rebecca Haycock from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The heavy beat. Every time I touch my beat, beat, beat. Going in heavy.